From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Employment can be an important step in recovering from mental illness, yet 80% of Americans receiving public mental health services are unemployed. We'll highlight Hope Clubhouse in Fort Myers, which provides a supportive environment for adults living with mental illness and provides opportunities for meaningful work. We'll get a preview of the nonprofit's upcoming mental health symposium. Plus, Moat Marine Laboratory and the Nature Conservancy have teamed up for a 15-year project aimed at conserving and restoring coral in Florida and the Caribbean. The joint venture includes the restoration of more than 1 million corals. We'll take a closer look at the effort and environmental threats facing coral health around the globe. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Coral reef cover in the Caribbean and Florida has decreased by 50-80% in just the last 3 decades due to environmental threats, including ocean acidification and rising ocean temperatures. Now, Moat Marine Laboratory and the Nature Conservancy have teamed up for a new project aimed at the conservation and restoration of coral in Florida and the Caribbean. Besides restoring more than 1 million coral, the effort aims to establish a network of coral gene banks to preserve the genetic diversity of coral tissue. A closer look at the effort and threats to the health of coral reefs coming up later this hour. But first, employment can be an important step in recovering from mental illness in terms of regaining dignity and providing focus and a sense of purpose to people's lives. However, a 2014 report from the National Alliance on Mental Illness finds that about 80% of Americans receiving public mental health services are unemployed. In Florida, that unemployment rate stands at nearly 85%. Hope Clubhouse of Southwest Florida is combating that problem through its efforts to provide a supportive environment for adults living with mental illness and by providing opportunities for meaningful work. We're taking a closer look at Hope Clubhouse's work and mission, including its new Edible Garden of Hope, ahead of the nonprofit's mental health symposium, Food for Thought, Feeding the Mind, Body, and Soul. That's October 24th at the Broadway Palm Dinner Theater in Fort Myers. Joining me now is Hope Clubhouse board member, mental health advocate, and symposium keynote speaker, Dottie Pacheris. Pacheris is also author of the book Mind on the Run, a bipolar chronicle based on her own son's struggle with bipolar disorder. Pacheris's articles have been featured in the News Press, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the Guardian, among other publications. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.
We're also joined in studio by Hope Clubhouse CEO James Weininger. He has nearly 30 years' experience in the mental health field. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And we're also speaking with Hope Clubhouse member and symposium speaker Cindy Bishop. Cindy, thanks for your time today, too.
Thank you.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation. Phone lines are open for your comments and questions at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And James, let's begin with you. Hope Clubhouse of Southwest Florida is one of about 350 facilities accredited through the International Center for Clubhouse Development. Tell us about, first of all, just this clubhouse model that this effort is based on.
Well, it really is fascinating. I started my career way back when. It's at the point where I just say more than 20 years now. But at the place that started it all, called Fountain House in New York City, and it's that movement back in the mid-1940s is now 34 countries, I think it is, close to 350 around the world, and organized by a group called Clubhouse International, and that's also based out of New York City. And it's really – it's an amazing way of working in this field of mental health and the way that we relate to each other to create this opportunity system that is Hope Clubhouse.
And how would you characterize the scope of mental health issues that Hope Clubhouse members are dealing with?
Well, it's a wide range of, you know, mental illness can mean so many things clinically. And I'm not a trained clinician. I've been in the field of social work for a long time, but we purposely stay on the side that's the what I say the non-clinical, not the anti-clinical. But But it can range from schizophrenia to bipolar, as Dottie's book chronicles so well. All sorts of different clinical diagnoses and pictures as that can look like.
And are all Clubhouse members necessarily residents as well, or do some folks just come and spend the structured day
part? Yeah, we don't own and operate any of our own housing units at this point. We help people access housing, but we essentially are a daytime Monday through Friday. So members come and volunteer in our program and help in so many various ways and create those relationships that then provide access to things like employment, housing, and education.
How do members typically first connect with Hope Clubhouse? Is it usually through a physician referral, or do folks kind
Absolutely. Of – Yeah, that, and that's it, – it's a there, it is a membership organization, so we do require an application process, but it's very simple. We just want to verify that there is a clinical diagnosis. And we also require at least a brief period of sobriety upon intake. So we're looking at of course, there's so many co-occurring conditions when you look at any mental health disorder that about half of our group has had some kind of substance abuse in their history at some point. So we're looking at a couple of those things, but it's a pretty easy process to get through.
All right. And, of course, members don't pay for these services, correct?
That is correct.
So how does the Clubhouse itself stay financially solvent then if you're not charging for any services?
That's a great question. We get about half of our operating expense does come from a couple of different government contracts. So we do get a mental health funding through Central Florida, which is the state mental health system here. We also get a contract through Lee County Human Services. So those two combine for about half of our roughly $400,000 operating budget. And then the other half we piece together through events like the one coming up at Broadway Palm, which with the educational focus, and also just through our generous supporters that we have. And we're continuing looking to increase that support base, as most nonprofits are.
Is there a typical length of time that members remain active with Hope Clubhouse, or is everybody just kind of on their own journey?
It's open-ended. We purposely have, you know, we operate by what we call the Clubhouse standards. There's 37 of them now. The first one is membership is voluntary and without time limits, so we don't really impose any time limits, but it's a great question. Some members will come in and get the help they need, get back into employment at whatever level they're looking to engage in employment, and then maybe stay connected on a periodic basis. And we may not see them every single day or week or even on a regular basis. But and then others will. So we'll take part more. So it really just depends on what the individual needs are and the support systems that people are in need of.
And earlier I had mentioned a high rate of unemployment among those receiving public mental health services, nearly 85% in Florida. And despite about $4 billion a year in federal funding for supported employment, the employment rate for those with mental illness has declined even more over the last decade. Do you have an idea what would account for this kind of trend or these high rates of unemployment? I mean, it sounds like it could be a lot of factors. I mean, even just social stigma.
There are so many factors. I think the economy in whichever part of the country. This is actually the third Clubhouse program I've worked in, from starting with in New York. So I think there's a local economy factor, certainly. But it's about creating those opportunities, which the Clubhouse does, and that support system. But it also takes the right partnerships and the right businesses that are going to offer those opportunities and be willing to work with the staff of the Clubhouse and create those jobs that are going to and partnerships with the agency, not just the one job for the one person today that might be looking, but for an ongoing relationship is what we're really trying to develop with some of the companies in Fort Myers.
And Cindy Bishop, as a member of Hope Clubhouse, can you tell me a bit about some of the work that you've done that maybe you feel is beneficial or that is going to carry you into the future?
Well, I started out as a receptionist, and I worked up to helping James with accounting and billing and different things that will definitely help me if I get a job. All I can say is the Clubhouse has been everything to me. It's like give me a new life.
Can you tell us a little bit about your story, maybe before you found the clubhouse, and tell us a little bit about how you found it?
I was raised with a lot of abuse. My memories came back about 44, and that's when I came into the mental health system and went through many diagnoses and doctors and, you name it. I was diagnosed with it. So, and then I had a friend that was very ill that I helped for 10 years. And he constantly talked about suicide. And so when he died, I went into severe, severe depression. And I wanted nothing to do with anybody. And I had a life coach through self-directed care program, and I had my my case manager through a place that I live called Renaissance Manor, and they both kept wanting me to go to the clubhouse. And being in depression, you don't want anything to do with anybody.
Right.
So they finally talked me into the clubhouse, and like I've told James, it's one of the few places I've ever walked in and immediately felt safe. It's just, it's had a big impact on me. There's no stigma there. Everybody is just like so supportive.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that benefit as well, just because when you are in an environment where you're surrounded by people who, if they don't know exactly what you are going through, they can empathize. They're going through their own mental or emotional issues as well. And so I can just see how, all that judgment that you might feel or that stigma that Cindy was just talking about would just kind of melt away.
That's certainly one of the goals that we have, and that, like the question you ask about what does mental illness look like, and it's actually an unusual question because we focus so much on the healthy parts of when people walk in, and we focus on the strengths that people have, and so it's not about the questions we ask each other aren't, what's your mental illness look like today? It's more about, do you want to help us make lunch, or do you want to help us with a newsletter or with reception and intake that Cindy's so helpful with on a day-to-day basis? So and that's what you're doing, is creating this place where the focus is not on the illness, it's on the wellness and the healthy parts of people.
And, James, you were quoted in the news press as saying that, people with mental illness often have poor nutrition and are drastically reduced lifespans as well.
Yeah, it's bad.
The nutrition issue, it was just something I wouldn't have thought about except in terms of, specific mental health issues related to an eating disorder, but that's not really the case at all.
And there's still a lot of, and I'm not trained medically, but there's a huge field that's emerging, of knowledge emerging around, why people with a mental illness are dying 25 years younger than people without a mental illness. And there's, there's all kinds of factors. It's higher rates of smoking, it's obesity, it's bad nutrition. There's a whole lot of things mixed in there. So the leading clubhouses around the world now are really coming out with some innovative wellness programming. And I think we're right there on the cutting edge with what we're doing in our gardening and bringing that into the, providing lunch and doing a meal program has been around since the 1940s with Fountain House. But taking it to that level where we're growing our own food and doing it in a way that's really thoughtful about what we're eating as well as what we're working on together is—I think that's one of the most exciting things that's happening in clubhouses around the world right now.
Is that happening? I mean, as far as you know, the gardens, the edible gardens. I mean, actually looking at perhaps the therapeutic benefits of even
Absolutely. Working
in a garden.
Yeah, it's really a trend. We're certainly not the first and not the only ones, but. But in my opinion, every single clubhouse needs to be doing at least what we're doing at Hope Clubhouse, and that's not the case. We're actually in the minority of taking the gardening to the level we have already, and we've only been doing it less than a year. So I think it's going to be exciting for me, and hopefully for the gardening and wellness community in Fort Myers to see that aspect of Hope Clubhouse continue to emerge over time.
Right. And Dottie Pacheris, sorry for just bringing you into the conversation now, keynote speaker for the event on the board of directors for Hope Clubhouse. And you've written a book about you and your own family's experience with your son's battle with bipolar disorder. Can you tell us just a little bit about you and your family's history and what's led you to become this tireless advocate for really kind of reform and, dare I say, overhaul of our mental health delivery system?
Well, my son was diagnosed at age 27. He became psychotic, delusional, and it actually took the assault of a police officer to get him committed. He was diagnosed with bipolar, sent to a mental health treatment facility where after 6 weeks of forced medications, he recovered and was able to resume his life. My son's secret to living with bipolar was to be medication compliant. I don't know why he would stop taking his meds. I'm not even sure he knew why, but he did. And each time he did, he suffered a psychotic break. He suffered 5 bipolar manic episodes and was hospitalized 14 different times in 5 different states as he traveled the East Coast trying to escape federal agents who he thought were trying to assassinate him. Mm. My family's problem was getting him treated. The current laws require that you be homicidal or suicidal before you can be involuntarily hospitalized. My son became very accomplished at beating the system. He outsmarted doctors, lawyers, judges, crisis control units, the police, and could, in his own little way, convince them he was not suicidal or homicidal, and he was released time and time again. And each time he was allowed to go untreated for long periods of time, he sustained further brain damage. Toward the end, pre-bipolar, a very successful entrepreneur, owned his own company, 6 employees, and I spent some time with him 3 months before he took his life. He lived a very pitiful, lonely existence. He had depleted all his savings. He was living off credit cards. He was a loner. He spent a lot of time sleeping. He was neglecting his personal hygiene, wore dirty clothing. Daily shower for him was no longer high on his priority list. And I knew the statistics for bipolar disorder, but I always held out hope he would not become one of those statistics. But sadly, he did. He took his life just after he turned 40. And after that, I became a mental health advocate. Too late to help my son, but I feel strongly that there are a lot of families out there that are dealing with the same set of circumstances that we did, and I try very hard to help them. And that was the purpose of writing the book, so that people would not feel they were alone. Other people go through the same set of circumstances.
Did you kind of feel like what you and your family was going through at the time, like you were alone until, you know, reaching out to other folks later on and just realizing that this was perhaps more common than you'd realized?
I did feel alone and frustrated with our broken mental health system that actually requires an individual to reach a crisis stage before you can have them treated. Mental illness is treatable. It does not have to result in suicide or homicide or homelessness. It is a treatable illness. And I feel that families should play a bigger part in treatment decisions. My son was too sick to know he was sick. He needed a caregiver or a family member to step in for him. Families are not permitted under current laws to nip a bipolar manic episode in the bud. They must sit by and actually watch their loved one deteriorate mentally until they reach the crisis stage. And that is wrong.
Well, tell me about, because I mentioned earlier you have written many op-ed pieces that have been published quite broadly in newspapers here and outside the U.S. Tell me about, you know, maybe some of the federal legislation that is on your radar right now. What kind of reforms would you like to see to our mental health care delivery system?
There have been multiple legislative proposals introduced in Congress to improve our mental health system. The strongest to help families who are dealing with severe mental illness is a bill from Congressman Tim Murphy from Pennsylvania. The bill is very appropriately named Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis. The bill was approved in Congress in July by a vote of 422-2. It was almost unanimous. It advanced to the Senate, where it sits. We had hoped the Senate might address it before they left for recess. They did not. So the hope now is that they will address it and hopefully pass it during the lame duck session after the election.
Well, we'll certainly be watching that. James, as far as, you know, any kind of legislation or efforts on the state level here in the state legislature, is there anything you're following or anything that you're looking for at the moment?
I actually appreciate Dottie's interest, and we've got other supporters that really kind of keep their ear to the ground on that. And I follow their lead and appreciate their kind of keeping me up to speed on what's going on. But, you know, that's an important bill, and, you know, it made me think about one of the other, just doing a little research before coming in, about the updated numbers in Lee County for people that are untreated mental illness. I think is a huge social issue, along with one of the hardest, any doctor or clinician will tell you, one of the hardest symptoms to treat of any mental illness is social isolation. And people, and so just by definition, it's hard to get a number of how many people are isolating socially, but it's a huge number. There are 35,000 people in Lee County have a serious mental illness, not just having a bad day or maybe have depression, but clinically diagnosable condition. That's that kind of one in – actually, that's about 20% of any population is going to have a serious the one in 20 – 5% actually. So that's the number of serious, and then of that, 60-70% are not getting the help they need. So, you know, I think if you talk to, and then that's where at the symposium we're going to get into more of this, because what that leads to is more people in the jail system, more people in the emergency room. So it's, you know, the cost to society of that group is, you know, it's really unfortunate, because there's other ways to provide the help that would be a lot more affordable.
Dottie, go ahead.
I'd like to add that our jails and prisons have become our new mental institute. The statistic is 40% of people incarcerated suffer from mental illness, and for the most part, they're not being treated.
Then there, on that same note, though, I know one of the speakers at the symposium is going to be the founder of Lee County's a mental health court program. Dottie, is that something that maybe begins to address the issue you were just discussing with incarceration?
I think it does address that situation. And I think Congress at long last is becoming aware of the cost to incarcerate thousands of people. And the stress on the hospital emergency rooms, holding patients because there's no psychiatric beds available for them.
And Dottie, as the keynote address speaker, I mean, I'm sure you'll be telling, you know, your own family story as well. But as far as from the advocacy side, what is it that you really want folks who attend this symposium to walk away with from hearing you speak?
I would like to stress that people suffering from severe mental illness are among the most marginalized and underserved in our society, and our failure to care for them comes at a high cost, not just in economic terms, but in wasted human potential. Yet with proper diagnosis and treatment, many patients are able to overcome their mental illness and go on and contribute to society and live a happy life.
Mm-hmm. And Cindy, you know, when you speak at the symposium next week, what do you want? What kind of message do you want to convey? What do you want people to walk away from hearing you speak, thinking or feeling?
I want them to know that it's not a shame to be mentally ill, that there is help out there, and it is a stigma. I've been on both sides of the problem, and I want to know that want them to know that there is help out there. I'm going to tell my story, which is a lot more involved than I can say here, mm-hmm. but and we want to make it clear that mental health and physical health kind of blend with each other. Like James said, there's more health problems with people that are mentally ill. And
okay. James, did you want to say something else?
I appreciate these two being on a great team that Hope Clubhouse has, and you know, we're looking for an exciting event. We've got a lot of community partners that have joined us and as sponsors, and that's what it's really about, getting you know the community involved in the conversation, raising awareness and reducing stigma and helping people find the help that they need, like Cindy just said. So.
And who is the intended audience for this symposium? Just any curious members of the public, mental health care professionals?
The whole community, really, mm-hmm. literally from top to bottom. And it's, you know, our list of sponsors includes some of our great corporate sponsors, mental health providers, nonprofits. So it really is just, you know, family members. A lot of family members have come to us and really Hope Clubhouse, a lot of Clubhouse programs started through the groups like NAMI. Both local NAMI groups are going to be there on Monday. So it really is anyone that has an interest in either getting help or giving help.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the program, but thanks so much to my guests. We've been speaking with Hope Clubhouse of Southwest Florida CEO James Weininger. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We've also been speaking with mental health advocate, Hope Clubhouse board member, author, and symposium keynote speaker, Dottie Pacheris. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we've been hearing from Hope Clubhouse member and symposium speaker, Cindy Bishop. Thanks for your time as well, Cindy.
Thank you.
Hope Clubhouse of Southwest Florida is holding a mental health symposium titled Food for Thought, Feeding the Mind, Body, and Spirit on October 24th from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. at the Broadway Palm Dinner Theater in Fort Myers. More information about the event can be found on our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live, or visit hopeclubhouse.org. We're taking a short break, but when we return, we'll learn about a new joint venture between Moat Marine Laboratory and the Nature Conservancy aimed at the conservation and restoration of coral in Florida and the Caribbean, including the establishment of a network of coral gene banks to preserve the genetic diversity of coral. That's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.